From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when the Rochester City School District revealed it was over budget. That information came after a year-end audit, and Superintendent Terry Data said he wants the district to be transparent. He has pledged that this shortfall is not going to result in teacher layoffs. He wants the students of Rochester to be protected, especially right now in this new school year. He doesn't want anyone panicking. But the actual dollar figure has fluctuated a bit from the initial reports. The latest report is that Rochester is about $30 million over budget. We'll talk about that. And almost immediately, leaders in different sectors jumped in to call for changes. For those who have advocated for a state takeover of the school board, well, this is fresh evidence that the district is not being managed properly. For those who want different board members in charge, this is an opening for a change in leadership. Well, this hour, we continue the conversation. We invite your feedback as well. And let me welcome our guests in studio. Willa Powell is a member of the Rochester City School Board, a commissioner for more than 20 years. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
And also with us is Eamon Scanlon, who's an education policy analyst for the Children's Agenda. Eamon, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We've heard from a lot of people in this community. It's a good chance to talk to Willa directly about how we got here. Normally, I'm not a big fan of this kind of a question. I don't like to just say, well, who's to blame for this? Because sometimes it's about point scoring or it's about, you know, different people are in power going to call for different people to be fired. Because the government is not a business. People say, well, government should run like a business. The government's not a business. In this case, however, this wouldn't fly in the business sector because you'd have to figure out how you got here and what you do about it. And so let's start with this. Who is to blame? I think that question is sort of relevant right now. How do we get to this kind of a shortfall?
I don't think we have the answer to that yet because our new superintendent is still trying to get to the bottom of that. What we know is that our interim superintendent before him was unaware of this and was blindsided by that. We know that from an interview that he did with WHAM. The board was not made aware of it back in May when we last discussed our 2018-19 budget.
Discussed with whom?
This would have been the Finance Committee of the whole. We receive monthly reports, and as of the May month, as of the May meeting, which was the last time we talked about 18-19 school year, we were told explicitly that their expectation was we would end the school year with a balanced budget. So with that backdrop, it's at this stage difficult or impossible to lay blame. We need to hear from the people who were working directly with the finances.
Now, a couple of points here just to make sure. When you say you were told back in May, told again by whom? What people are telling you that?
This would be the district CFO and budget personnel.
Okay, mm-hmm. So not other commissioners. You're talking about the people who are within the district whose charge it is to draw up the budget.
Correct.
And so when that happens, Commissioner Powell, when the budget is being put together, I think the public isn't always aware. I'm frankly not always aware. If you are really granular with it, if you're almost line by line, or if you are big themes about priorities, but the granular detail is left to the people in the district office and not the board itself. How does that work?
Different board members approach it differently.
Okay.
I would say there's a both and. There's a big picture thematic approach that some of us take. For example, we know that personnel and benefits and healthcare, transportation, those are the big rocks in the budget, and we're always working to try to make sure that our estimates are on point with that, because you can't build a budget unless you have really good estimates about where the money, you know, what the expenses are going to be. Other people, and certainly when board members come to it with a particular focus, will pay attention at the microscopic level to whether their programs are being funded to the degree that they want them to be funded at.
Okay. And if I could, I also want to read a comment from a person who has been in a leadership position in this community for a while. And this is a message that I'm not going to put a name to it. I've been talking to a lot of people from different backgrounds, and this is just one perspective from a person who has been in positions of leadership in Rochester. Quote, The rush to judgment on the RCSD budget deficit has been alarming to me. First, whatever the dollar amount, it will be less than a half of 1% of the budget. For anyone who knows budgeting, this is normal. There are plenty of ways to bring that number close to zero. First of all, do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Are we blowing this out of proportion?
It has been blown out of proportion. I believe that people who want to see us fail have glommed on to this and to take advantage of that's one more thing. That's one more thing the district's done wrong, when in fact we got out ahead of this. As soon as it was known that there was going to be a gap to make up, disclosed that to the public. That word came from the district, not from some secret source. So we're trying to be honorable and transparent about this. And yes, we've been down this road before. When Dr. Janey ended his career almost 16, 17 years ago, he ended it by overspending on personnel, on hiring. That was about a $21 million gap. The present day value of those dollars is much more than $21 million. So we've been in this position before. We have survived it before.
But how common is it to have a shortfall of any kind?
Oh, sure. It's very common. I mean, you don't hear about it from suburban districts because they gather their tax revenues directly. They are able to develop fund reserves to handle these sorts of things, and you never hear about it. It's only because this district has had a dwindling fund balance. Only because we have almost nowhere to go to get money to balance the budget, that it's such a hot issue.
So this is somewhere that, again, I'm going to be very transparent about my own ignorance on the law at times, because I think it's just helpful. We're all trying to learn through this together here. My understanding is the law says you have to have a reserve fund. Is that correct or
no.
Incorrect? So you don't have to.
As a matter of fact, what the law says is it limits how much money you can put aside for disaster. The city school districts are limited to 2% of their operating budget.
Which would be how much?
A $900 million budget. It's about
180 million.
The problem, of course, with the city school district is we never have enough revenues coming in to be able to fill that.
I might have
that.
Just done math incorrectly there. Even 18 million. 18 million based on the 2%. Okay.
So there's that. The suburban districts are entitled to have twice that much or 4% in reserves.
Why?
Just because that's the way the law is written.
That is the actual law?
That's
so if you're a suburban district, you can have a reserve fund of 4%, a rainy day fund, essentially, and the city school district can only have 2%?
And on top of that, that's just the unrestricted fund balance. They can also create dedicated fund balances. This is why Governor Cuomo was so angry at school funding in general, is because many of the suburban districts had enormous fund balances stashed away instead of reducing property taxes to just what was necessary. They had pockets of money hidden all over the place. RCSD, because we've been chronically underfunded for decades, simply does not have that resource available to us.
Do you have any reserve fund?
We had enough reserve fund that when our CFO presented the budget last year, he laid out a graphic that showed how we would have to wean ourselves from the fund balance before we came to zero. And we only had a couple of years to
let me just make sure I understand. How much is in the reserve fund right now?
I can't answer that honestly with absolute accuracy, but I would say it's in the $20 million range. It's not a lot.
Okay, it's not enough to cover the shortfall.
Well, there's a difference between cash flow and fund balance.
Okay.
Okay? There's a difference because of when the money comes in. We can be flush at some points in time because the state is funding us and the city is providing revenues. In this instance, on top of the shortfall, the city explicitly told us this year that they were not going to pay out the $119 million on the same timetable that they had paid it out in previous years. So we are $40 million less in cash reserves than we would have been this time last year. That is why the district had to request a bond anticipation note this summer. And some people thought that that $50 million bond anticipation note represented what our shortfall was. They were jumping to conclusions. That $50 million in borrowing was to make up for the fact that the city wasn't going to give us the aid that we're already entitled to on the same timetable that they have in the past.
All right, one more question. I know Eamon will have a lot to say about this, and we'll invite listener feedback as we talk about the Rochester City School District. 844-295-TALK if you want to join the program. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. To kind of make sure I understand how, for lack of a better term, common or normal this would be, I understand when you've got moving targets about what revenues and funding you're going to have to work with. There will always be a projected, and then there will always be an actual. And the actual is almost never going to equal the projected. You want to be close because you want to be realistic. You don't want to have a massive shortfall for obvious reasons. How big is this shortfall historically? You've been a commissioner for 20-plus years. How big is this one?
This is bigger than I am comfortable with. Often what happens in our budget cycle is as we come close to the end of the year, we try to have money left over, money unspent. And at the end of the year, what we do, we call it sweeping the accounts or gathering up all the unspent funds and put it back into our reserves. Often we have money that we can sweep into the reserves at the end of the year, more often than not, actually, because grants come through during the course of the year, and we're able to shift our spending from general fund to grant-funded programs. But let me just say, this is not a comfortable place. This is not typical or normal. We try to budget conservatively. We try to estimate expenses high and revenues low. That's a standard accounting principle. So this isn't really, this is not typical, and it is concerning.
Eamon, I know you have a lot to say. Go ahead.
Thanks. And before I start, I just want to wish my wife a happy anniversary.
You're here on an anniversary day. This is a big story.
Yeah, no, my weekend was terrible. But I want to wish her a happy anniversary. I also want to wish my mom well. She's been dealing with some medical issues. So getting into the budget, I want to zoom out a little bit. I think it's easy to get lost in the wonkiness, the minutiae here. There is no evidence, for what we know so far, that money was misdirected for corrupt reasons or, to line somebody's pockets, or that there was a conscious decision made to spend more money than should have been spent. What appears to be the facts are things were not properly projected for, and then there were pretty substantial cost overruns in those areas. And some of those areas have already been identified by the superintendent. Substitutes, contract transportation, charter school tuition, and there's been a lot also about benefits. So that's the overall context. However, I think that this could have been predicted to some extent, and part of the reason is you have to kind of go back to March and April of 2018 when this budget was being created. That was a pretty chaotic time for the district. There was a lot of negative headlines about special education. It was certainly after the death of Trevion Rowe, untimely death of Trevion Rowe. A lot of pressure to fix and increase spending on special education. At the same time, you had the crisis of students coming over from hurricane-affected areas, particularly Puerto Rico. There was an enrollment increase of 560 students, so a lot of bilingual programs had to be built out. And the superintendent and the board had put a big priority on increasing reading intervention teachers. And so there was also a push to do a lot more remedial and proactive work to improve reading scores. So there was all this pressure to increase spending, and then at the same time, you had a $52 million budget gap. And from what I know about the budget process, it was very rushed at that time. Ultimately, the draft budget was not balanced, and it wasn't till the kind of 12th hour at the very end that there was a balanced budget presented to the board and then voted on. And many of the decisions to close that gap were made kind of last minute. There was some back and forth between the superintendent team and the finance office about who should be making these decisions and where these kind of lie. Ultimately, it seems like there was a lot of pressure exerted on the finance department to come up with additional revenue. And that came from a few different places. And one of those, a lot of people talk about fund balance. I want to put the fund balance aside here because that's a source of revenue, not cost. And so people get confused about that. The real issue here was that there was a lot of pressure on a bunch of areas where the assumptions would have led you to put the numbers much higher. And those were budgeted down, actually. If you look between what the original draft budget and then the final adopted budget for retiree benefits, all over that was revised down by about $10 million. Not because, you know, we suddenly decided we're going to have less retirees. It was sort of just a fudge. But then I want to also say in the context, and this is a very complicated issue, there are often overruns in a lot of different areas. Some of the areas that have been identified, there are typical overruns in contract transportation, in substitutes. That's a real problem for the district. They often spend millions more than they budget for. But it seems like the cumulative effect of trying to increase spending and essentially taking the guardrails off in terms of where revenue could be made up really caught up with the district in the end. So that's kind of the big picture. And I know Willa wants to respond, and I that's
okay. So let's let the commissioner respond to that. And then what I really want to hear from Eamon is the work that you do at the Children's Agenda is exactly what some of the superintendent laid out, which is that when you have moments like this, how do you make sure kids are protected, students are protected, learning and teacher support is protected? We'll talk to Eamon about that in a moment, but I know you want to respond to some of what you heard.
Sure, thank you. I want to applaud Eamon for like nailing this one right on the head.
He was a policy analyst.
Of course he would. No, but in particular, let me address this concept of overruns in charter school tuition should never have happened. That's where I want to focus on, because the accounting principle of conservatism says you count every seat that's in charter schools, which we knew at the time, and you assume every seat's going to be filled, and you assume transportation costs for every one of those students. It's surprising and disturbing to me that we could possibly have underestimated in that area, because that's the one area that it's safe to assume 100% enrollment in charter schools based on past enrollments. The fact that we might have underestimated those costs suggests to me that there was a subliminal or emotional pressure to balance the budget by underestimating expenses rather than
pressure from who?
Well, I know that Barbara Dean Williams, who was the superintendent at the time that we were creating this budget, had a profound distaste for any cuts anywhere close to the classroom, and that she wasn't precisely encouraging the academic side of the house to contribute towards a balanced budget during the budget negotiations. Part of the reason that there was so much last minute, 12th hour, as Eamon said, in terms of delivering a balanced budget to the board, is because the academic side of the house, quite frankly, was not cooperating with the process of getting to a balanced budget. And I believe that her philosophy was that it's okay to create a crisis, you know, in terms of getting the state's attention and showing that that we're not getting enough state funding to do the job. I think that was her fundamental philosophy. That did not make it easier for the board, you know, who has to, and anyone else who had to live through it after she left.
Okay. So, Eamon, now, when you look at what happens next and sort of following through on that mission of making sure that if there are impacts, that they impact actual education and opportunity for kids, what needs to happen? How do you see the landscape now?
Well, we need to have a real transparent process about, I mean, we don't even really know the exact dollar figure yet. We have sort of a ballpark of it. We have to come up with a structured plan around how that's going to impact the classroom. But when we say we, I really think there needs to be understanding for parents, for the community, to know what this means. Because like this 12-hour process, this sort of last-minute changes, that doesn't filter down to the general public or the parent or the child in the classroom. And for them not to understand the implications of these financial decisions and then things get made after the fact, that can be very damaging. So just having a very open, transparent process. But ultimately, in the long run, I will say, sort of to Willa's point, you know, the bigger context is the district does have money that it is owed by the state based on their own calculations that would have closed this gap. And the money that was spent was to improve reading, was to improve special education. This was actually went to the classroom, that money, when we look at the total big picture overruns. And then also in the last 2 years, further context, we've seen improvements, particularly in areas of focus like special education, like graduation rate. So it's a very muddled picture. And we can't just think of this as let's cut to balance the budget. That is the fiscal duty of the district. That has to happen. But the fact that we need resources to support kids is the real issue here. It's not, you know, $10 million or $20 million. It's that we don't have the achievement level and the success for the students in this community that it should be. And we need to be transparent about what the challenges are and how we get to a place where we do have adequate resources to meet their needs.
You both keyed in on charter schools, Willa in particular, Commissioner Powell in particular. So just for listeners to better understand here, when the superintendent takes a look at the list of reasons that we know that the shortfall exists, and costs regarding charter schools is one of them, how big of a factor of that menu of items? Do we know, Commissioner Powell?
Not precisely.
Eamon?
Yes. So... Well, I mean, I have numbers based on their budget books. And
okay.
Normally, like Willa said before, the charter school tuition usually is over budgeted because you account for all the seats and then you get a little bit of a windfall at the end of the year. This time it was $7.3 million over. So
how does that happen?
Well, this, you know, I went back and looked and it's very confusing. So there in the budget book, it actually says back in 1819, we believe there'll be 450 new seats, and that will lead to an addition of $2 million in spending. Well, if you just do a back of the envelope, multiply what the charter school tuition rate is per pupil by 450 seats, that's actually a little over $6 million. So that just seems like a complete, I don't know what happened. I can't speak to that, but the numbers do not jive with the reality that are even published within the book itself. And if you were to do the numbers faithfully based on what we know about the increase in rate for every student and the additional students, we'd basically get the gap. I think that the information was there. It just wasn't followed or was miscalculated for whatever reason.
Is that right? Is that fair, Commissioner?
That sounds like a very reasonable autopsy. Mm-hmm.
For those who have said this is a time where we should see, at least within the Board of Commissioners, resignations, maybe not entire posts, but resignations from leadership positions, that we should put new people in charge or more granularly in charge of finance, whether it's Beatrice LeBron or others. Is it time for change within the board on who is doing what, Commissioner Powell?
Well, given the fact that the interim superintendent didn't see this coming, given the fact that the board as a whole, in its meeting as a whole, in May, was told to expect a balanced budget, I have to ask the question, if someone else had been chairing the Finance Committee, would we have come to any different place? It's not reasonable to assume that if the entire board and the superintendent were told one thing, that the outcome would be different if someone else sat in my seat.
Some of the more stringent calls from certain quarters that have said for months now that the supporters of a state takeover of the school board have viewed this as a reason to say the board members who have been there the longest, the Van Whites, the Willa Powells, should resign outright for this. What do you say to that?
Well, that's pure opportunism at work. We've also had a lack of funding since well before I ever took office. I remember 2 years into my first term, Rick Dollinger holding a press conference saying that the funding formula as it existed at that time was not being lived up to because they never took the cap off of the revenue stream. So those state legislators are still there. There are city council members who have been there since revenue calculations were set at $119.1 million, which was 19 years ago. The present value of those dollars means we're about $40 million behind on an inflation-adjusted curve just from our city revenue side. So there's a lot of people who are responsible, who contribute to the underlying causes of this district's overall distress, notwithstanding sure. the specifics of this year's problem.
And I take the point that you're making, that you view this as opportunism, that it is divisive and not helpful. So I don't view this, I'm not asking you this in any sort of a gotcha sense, but do you find yourself culpable in any way for the fact that the district somehow didn't know that the shortfall was going to be there?
Well, you know, I asked myself that question when it first came up, and I went back to our monthly financial reports, looking at the variance column, like, at what point was it disclosed to us that we were outrageously off of our budget? And, you know, like, was I not paying attention? You know, what did I miss? And I just don't see it. I don't see that that I have done anything differently than anyone else in my position would have done.
Okay. Amen.
So a lot of this hinges on what was communicated and known by the finance department to the board and others, and you know, I simply can't speculate on that. The thing that is evident is there are breadcrumbs looking over some of the past documents, and it is concerning that nobody caught this because, you know, we forget there was a state monitor, there was a distinguished educator, there was plenty of pressure and folks, you know, as Willow would say, that would like the opportunism of this, and yet they did not identify this. So I think a lot of this went to the trust that people had in the finance office and that what was said was true, and there wasn't enough due diligence to really dig into the numbers because it is a huge time commitment. And simply, if you trust somebody, you're not always going to do your best. And that's unfortunate given where we are. If you go back and look, and this was something very interesting at the May report, and I want to also add here, and this is maybe a question for Will, I don't really understand why there was no year-end report and why when you would have, you know, you would have recognized this when you had your June report or your year-end report to say, okay, let's square up all the numbers. But what happens is you have a May report and then you skip. There's no report the next month, and then you skip and you start looking at the 1920 budget. So it's almost like we said, oh, we're not going to dig into what our year-end numbers. Well, that would have been the first place you would have definitely had this conversation. And then if you look at the May report, it's very confusing. But after going through the numbers a few times, there seems to be some I don't know how to characterize this. I'll just say what there was. There's this grand total line when you look over the financial documents that are basically, you would think, oh, this is what our budget is. And it is. It's your amended budget, but it's not your actual commitments and what all the different lines are summed up to. There's a subtotal line. And that line was $947 million in the May report versus the $933 million that was the full budget. So it already showed, kind of hidden in the numbers, that you were going over by about $14 million. It's just for some reason that was not communicated or caught, and nobody really saw that.
Okay. You want to hit that briefly?
The question that Eamon first asked about why was there no June report, which is the last month of the fiscal year, it goes back to many years of tradition where, because the books don't get for the year don't get closed out right at the end of June, because we know we have the external auditors coming in to help us identify whether a cost is assigned to the previous year or the next year, because there's carryover of grant revenues from one year to the next, we have for many years now suspended a distribution of the unaudited June report to the board so that the final numbers would come from the audit, from the external auditors. It has not historically been cause for concern because, as I said earlier, often we are able to sweep funds and actually put more into the reserves and slightly below the amended budget rather than over.
We're going to get to some phone calls and some feedback on various platforms after our only break of the hour as we try to break down what we know about what's going on in the Rochester City School District and what that means going forward with Willa Powell, a member of the Rochester City School Board, a commissioner for more than 20 years now. Eamon Scanlon, an education policy analyst for the Children's Agenda, is also with us. Your phone calls and emails and tweets are next. Coming up in our second hour, we discuss a new dance video you might have seen moving around various parts of the internet. It's called Body Love. It celebrates female empowerment, and it is all about the pressures that society puts on women in particular when it comes to image, what is acceptable or expected or beautiful. We'll talk about the themes of body love next hour. This is Connections and some of your feedback now. Starting on Twitter, Robert Hoggard, who ran for school board this year, says the following. First of all, there's been no mention about how central office is too big. This was something mentioned in Dr. Aquino's report and has yet to be addressed. Instead of thinking about laying off teachers, have we thought about laying off central office technocrats, the chief of schools, and et cetera? Commissioner Powell.
When comments like that come in, it's very clear that the person asking doesn't realize how much paperwork has to be pushed between the district and the state, doesn't realize the complexity of the planning that has to happen, the supervision of subordinates that has to happen. The superintendent cannot do all that for 60 schools.
So Dr. Aquino was wrong?
Dr. Aquino didn't specifically say that we needed to reduce central office at the cabinet level. He invited the superintendent to restructure so that he had more direct control over the decision-making process.
Do you think then that there is any, the blunt term would be dead weight. I don't mean to be that blunt because everyone is trying to do effective jobs, I'm sure. But you don't think there is any way to save money at the, sort of the top end then?
Is there any way? Yeah, there are ways. You know, when I first started on this district, there was no internet. Microsoft Word was kind of new. Secretaries were still the way documents were created, typists, stenographers. That's a lifetime ago. Now, people need to be typing their own documents, proofreading their own documents. So the role of an extensive staff or deep staff at any of these offices is less necessary than it was 20 years ago for those technology reasons. But at the same time, the district has had to find places to cut every year to deal with a structural budget gap for as long as I have been a part of this district. And so to the extent that there is any fat left I really question that. At this point, we're cutting to the bone.
Eamon, Robert follows up to say, I'd push back to Eamon's comment about the cost of education. It's hard for RCSD to ask for money through the CFE when we have one of the highest per pupil spending formulas in the country, but some of the worst outcomes in the country.
Well, first of all, in the context of Monroe County, just looking at the different per pupil spending, if you really dig into the numbers, it's not really that much higher. And even by some calculations, it's not even the highest in the county when you really factor in some of the money that's more of a pass-through, because people often divide the whole budget by the number of students and they forget the $90 million that's going out the door for charter school tuition, a lot of other factors. So that's a talking point that's, I think, just a piece of misinformation in the community. And then you dig into the needs of the students. It's very different in terms of the district serving special ed, which has been a real problem area for a number of years, is very expensive. You spend about 250% more per student on average in any school district in the state for a special needs child. And so when you have about twice as many proportionally special needs children to serve as any other Monroe County district, it's a very different cost structure. So it's a very complicated issue, but I would sympathize with the point more so that money that's being spent is not always effectively spent. And so what I mean by that is that when you have a lot of grant funding programs that come and go, there's not the consistency. When you have a lot of turnover in leadership positions and in central office, those people are not able to hold people accountable or do process improvement and continuous improvement. So there's probably a lot more where we see money being spent where it should be spent, but it, for a number of reasons and factors, it never gets to the level of effectiveness we should expect. And a lot of that is the instability and pressures that the district faces. Is there fat? I think there probably is, but it's in ways that are a lot harder to track and understand. Beatrice often brings up the point that there were departments, two departments, the Human Resources Department, and the legal department that handed out raises that were not approved to their staff, and then they had to be retroactively approved by the board. So there are little things that happen around the edges where there could be much more fiscal discipline, but I think in the bigger picture, we're just not getting the most out of the money we do spend.
Let me get back to the phone, and this is Kate in Rochester. Go ahead, Kate.
I just had a couple of comments, one being there was a report late last year about the salaries that the board has compared to their peers throughout the state. Most of school board members are paid around $15,000 per year, and we're paying $34,000 per school board member. And so it seems that we are not necessarily getting the results from paying twice what the state average is. And then secondarily, my other comment is that because there is a real lack of confidence here in that maybe the board has too much board, what I would call board speak, that people are getting reports and then taking them as rote instead of really clawing through the data, that shouldn't there be a new full-time position just dedicated to being an auditor on the board instead of a committee member, so that every single report, like your speaker was talking about with the 450 students times the average rate, would have been close to $7 million, that would be a glaring figure that would have immediately been questioned and highlighted instead of taken as the actual budget.
Okay. Thank you, Kate. Commissioner Powell, you want to start?
Well, as a matter of fact, since 2008, we have had a Auditor General, which is a full-time employee that works for the Board of Education, and we have a Standing Audit Committee that meets quarterly that Beatrice LeBron is the chair of. These were changes to education law that were envisioned by then Comptroller Hevesy and became part of the law with the Contract for Excellence law that Governor Spitzer passed that in fact created the Contract for Excellence, the supposed new money we were supposed to get, but we aren't getting. So the mechanisms are there. we have an auditor general and staff to review not only district books, but also practices to try to identify best practices and efficiencies. So as for salaries, some of those facts aren't right, and they don't help my case, but most board members across the state don't receive any salaries. It's a volunteer position. But the school district has received a salary since before it was a state function. It was part, when education was part of the city government, school board members received $1,200 a year, and city wardsmen, the predecessor to city council members, only got $750 a year for their service. It was understood from the beginning that school board member work was more complex and more difficult than city council work. Now, and so city council members used to get about three quarters of what a school board commissioner got. Today, it's exactly the reverse. City council, school board gets three quarters of city council salary. So if city council or the community thinks that we are receiving too much in income, they need only go to the city council and demand that city council reduce their own salary.
Amen.
I think it's a little bit of a distraction. I understand the moral argument, and we could talk about why, you know, the district with the lowest outcomes pays their board the highest, and I understand that narrative. But you add all the money up, you're talking about a couple hundred thousand dollars, and the issues here are in millions and in tens of millions. So it's definitely a step that could be taken if the board wants to set an example and wants to have that high ground. In terms of closing budget gaps, you know, it's not going to get you very far. So I don't want to waste too much time thinking about those numbers. It's more of a cudgel and a talking point. But in terms of how we get better controls and how we move forward to make sure things like this don't happen, there was a report, an internal report the district did. Rick Timms was a hired consultant to look over and make recommendations. And that report, along with some of my own findings when I started this project, unluckily enough on the first year was this budget and this chaos, was that it was really hard to red flag things because lines move around a lot. And things change mid-year, things change between budgets. And so it's hard to go, oh, wait, why is this going up? Because I'd really have to ask, why are 50 things going up? Why are 50 other things going down? And you just need a lot of knowledge and structure and in-depth conversations to see all the moving pieces. And so I think this is why things get missed, is that there's not consistency and stability around what numbers mean, around what numbers are. And things fall through the cracks, and it is a problem, and it needs to be fixed.
Gretchen in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Gretchen.
Hi. First, let me say that I'm glad you have these shows, Evan. And I voted for Willa. I respect her quite a lot. The other gentleman I don't know, but you're giving good facts. Some facts that I know, my husband worked for the city in finance from 89 until... he had to stop working when he was ill around 2005. And every single year, by the end of September, beginning of October, the city was coming back, or the school board was coming back to the city for more money because they had spent down all the money they'd been given. And that was a big frustration for the city because they just didn't have the money to dole out again. You know, obviously, Bill Johnson tried to, for his terms, he wanted to get control of the city board because he knew it was being mismanaged, and he wanted the kids to do better. And what your guys are talking about, the special ed situation, there are way more situations with special ed kids in the city than other districts because they're coming from so much poverty. And we have to accept these things, and it's literally racist for us not to. And until we can merge the urban with the suburban and have a central district, I can just see the city school district is going to go down and down and down and down, and the charter schools are going to fill up. And I see kids doing better in the charter schools, but I don't think they're the answer. I think There is so much money around the city in the suburban areas, and if people could get past their fear of difference, it would be so much better to merge these schools, because there would be enough to go around, and the kids would get the help they needed, and the kids who are already doing well would do better. And we wouldn't have this problem of all these children not graduating and not being able to go to technical school or some kind of college after they got out of school. We have to look at this as it's a Monroe County-wide issue. You know, it's a regional issue. It's not just the city of Rochester.
Yeah, and Gretchen, let me just jump in, because it's a whole separate conversation. And it's one that in many ways we've been having and we need to continue to have. But one interesting and important, I think, frame of reference here, when you think about the people who want a state takeover, starting with Mayor Warren. Mayor Warren's been the mayor of this city for about 6 years. We have not seen poverty and it's been intractable. We haven't seen severe poverty, child poverty. We've essentially not seen it move. I'm not someone, and I hope listeners aren't someone, who expects that to change in 6 months or a year. But in 6 years, we've seen essentially no change with that. The mayor's calculation is it's almost entirely a school district issue, that poverty is going to be intractable until the schools are fixed. And so her framing is largely that it has to start in the schools. That what is the city to do? Because otherwise, it would logically follow that the mayor would call for the state to take over city council and the mayor's office, too, for the same reasons. But she doesn't view it that way. She views it as starting with the schools, and that poverty could largely start to be ameliorated if the schools were better or reformed or doing their jobs. Whereas many others say, if you had poverty reduced, you wouldn't fix everything. And reforming is a good goal, but you'd go a long way to fixing some of the intractable problems that districts like Rochester have. And so, Gretchen, I take the point. We're not going to have a countywide district tomorrow. It's an ongoing conversation about that issue. And I know Willa wants to jump in, so go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, I appreciate what you just said, Evan. But the interesting fact is that over the last 6 years, graduation rates have improved, notwithstanding that we've received...
Yeah, the mayor says not enough.
Well, we're making as much progress as circumstances allow. And we're making more progress on our end than she's making on hers. And I don't mean that as a out of meanness. It's just a fact that we're impacting students and getting better results, even though the circumstances these students have come from have not improved.
Okay. Eamon, you want to comment on that briefly?
Yeah, I just think that as much as the Distinguished Educator Report said, we often are talking about adult problems and not students. This is a little bit of an example where we can get kind of lost in that. And I really want the focus to be on both the individual students, not just the system. And we need to think about how we structure that system. But are we going to put additional resources into the pot if we went to a regional system? How do we guard against the inequities between suburban districts? Because there is a difference between some of the programming and availability depending on the east and west side. So there are bigger equity questions that go along with the regional approach, and it drills down to the individual student. Does every student get access to the programming and supports they need to graduate and to live successfully and have the opportunities they need?
Incidentally, Mayor Warren is invited on this program whenever she likes, and I really hope that she'll take the opportunity to come back, talk about schools, talk about a number of issues. But let me close with this, Commissioner Powell. I take your point when you say you've searched for all the different ways you could have seen as a commissioner that this shortfall was coming, and that while shortfalls happen, this is a larger one than you're comfortable with, and there's going to be problems to deal with as a result. What I haven't heard this hour is something that indicates, well, here's how we know this won't happen next year. How are you going to get there?
Well, first you start by keeping a cool head. You know, one of the things that Rudyard Kipling wrote in his poem, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming on you, and the poem goes on to say, then you have become a man. It's the adult way of approaching things. We need to be more focused in the next budget cycle on honest assessments of the expenses, and to make sure that we because I think, I personally think that that is the problem, is that we were being too generous and lenient about what the expenses were, because it, psychologically, unconsciously allowed us to close a gap, you know, not in reality, but in our heads. So we need to have the honest conversation about the expense side. And then we need to have a conversation with those who fund us, the state legislature.
Commissioner, I appreciate you making the time to come on the program today. And I hope we can continue the conversation.
And I'm sad, sorry that Natalie Shepard couldn't come, because I understand she was the one supposed to be sitting in the seat.
That's okay. Commissioner Shepard has been with us many times. We, of course, appreciate your time, the president of the board. We have a very accessible school board, and that's important. The question is, you know, are we going to find the right path forward? So thank you for being here.
Thank
Eamon
you.
Scanlon is an education policy analyst with the Children's Agenda. Our best to you and all of your family today. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes, thank you very much. And we'll be putting out the Children's Agenda some blog posts to get into this more. So if you go to thechildrensagenda.org over the next few days, if you really want to dig into the numbers.
Thechildrensagenda.org. More connections coming up.